I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Rita Kaganzen, Associate Director of the Program on Constitutionalism and Democracy and Assistant Professor of Politics at the University of Virginia. We're discussing her recent book, Liberal States, Authoritarian Families, Childhood and Education in Early Modern Thought, from Oxford University Press. Kaganzen's research focuses on the themes of education, childhood, authority, and the family in historical and contemporary political thought, and she is the author of several articles on these topics. All right, first of all, let me say, Rita Kaganzen, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thanks for having me.
Rita, love the book. It's great. Analysis of early modern political thought, particularly Locke and Rousseau on education, and interesting application and significance for contemporary debates. Certainly, this is a topic that's been in the news a lot. So, first of all, congratulations on the book. Let me ask you, first of all, what was the motivation for writing the book in the first place? Why did you take up this topic of education, and why focus on the early moderns?
Well, I've always been interested in education since I was getting one. And when I was in high school, I sort of noticed this problem. I was like a very bad kid, I guess. I was insubordinate, as my transcripts noted. And I got suspended and I had lots of detentions and things like that. And one thing that struck me was just that nobody wanted to sort of exercise authority. In my high school, I went to a big public high school in the suburbs of Chicago. And I found that very strange because it seemed like, basically what I was doing was just taunting them and they just gave into it. And I never really understood why they wouldn't want to sort of defend themselves. There was this kind of sense that the teachers tried to be your friends. They were nice to you up until the point where you weren't nice back, and then they would just punish you. And when I went to the university, that was the first time that I sort of encountered real sort of intellectual authority. And my experience of it was just that I stopped wanting to rebel, and I stopped wanting to be insubordinate, and I stopped wanting to taunt these people because I felt that they said they had really something to teach me, that there was something that I needed to learn from them. And I just sort of chilled out very rapidly. And so this experience sort of made me wonder about why, my high school teachers had not been more like this, more the way that my college professors were, and how it is that we're sort of going to, how it is that we can claim to maintain order in education in a regime that emphasizes so centrally the equality of everybody. And of course, adolescence is like this sort of liminal stage in which your equality is really sort almost there, and where people, high school teachers, would want to respect it. And that actually seemed to be the problem, is this desire to treat students as equals, which led to really ineffectual education. And whereas that really reversed in college, and a lot of it had to do with the dynamics of people voluntarily being there and things like that. But there was no sort of discipline problem anymore. If you didn't want to go to college, you would leave college. And if you were there, it was because you thought that this was a valuable place to be. And everybody sort of accepted the authority of the teachers. And so it was that experience that sort of made me think about how authority works in education, and especially why liberal democracy might pose difficulties to establishing the kind of authority that I experienced at the university at other levels. And so that was sort of my first interest in it. And I turned to the early moderns because it was sort of in Locke and Rousseau that you seem to find the beginning of this problem really being seriously and explicitly addressed, that they were thinking about a regime in which there was individual liberty and sort of widespread or at least growing social equality and mobility. And that they saw that this posed a kind of difficulty for educating children who couldn't really be treated as equals, and yet in some theoretical way were equals.
Rita, you as a disciplined as at an early age, I would never believe it. But there we have it. This is not at all part of your book, but I'm curious, and I know that you know something about this, but this sort of development about teachers at primary and secondary school sort of being your friend, the, you know, a softer view of teacher authority. This is a relatively new development, right? So, what? I mean, when did that happen? And you know, what accounts for that transformation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's largely an outgrowth of sort of progressive theories of education, sort of late 19th century, early 20th century pedagogy. I mean, John Dewey was a major exponent of this in the United States. And others who were sort of around him and were influenced by slightly different sources, Maria Montessori. I mean, we see that in early childhood education. And it's an idea that, you know, children learn best when they learn it themselves, which actually comes from Rousseau. I mean, this is sort of the misinterpretation of Rousseau as applied to schools, right? So it's true, Rousseau does say this, that, you know, if you really wanted to teach a child something, they have to understand it themselves. You can't just convey knowledge to them in a hierarchical way, except that Rousseau also says you can't have schools. But, you know, the reception of Rousseau through sort of Central Europe into the United States starts to try to institutionalize his pedagogical insights. And so that really comes to a head in the progressive era with this development of progressive education, which, you know, is really sort of practiced on the elite, but it then becomes more diffused through education schools. And so it becomes sort of what teachers are taught by the 1950s and 1960s, even though it's really hard to practice in a large public school context. And so it is even worse in practice than it is in theory a lot of times, just because the context is not very conducive to it. But the idea is that, you know, you should not have a hierarchical, you, the teacher, should not have a kind of hierarchical position relative to the student. You should be the guide on the side and not the sage on the stage. That's a nice, you know, ed school way of putting it. And as a result, the sort of the hierarchy between teacher and student and the authority difference between teacher and student is supposed to be erased as much as possible. And that's supposed to be more conducive to children's learning. But it's not really clear that it has had that result.
So it's for, you think it's for pedagogical reasons that was transitioned, as opposed to sort of principled reasons having to do with, well, the logic of congruence that you end up talking about, that is the...
Yeah, well, that's why it gets accepted. I mean, the argument is a pedagogical argument about how children learn. I think the reason it gets so widely diffused is because it makes sense in our regime. It is very hard for us to exercise authority or any kind of hierarchical relationship over anybody, because liberalism is a regime that's premised on individual liberty and individual equality. And that's how we're supposed to treat each other in the public sphere. And that is generally how we do treat each other in the public sphere. And so it's very strange to encounter situations in which we are asked to exercise authority over other people to which they have not consented, because all authority is consent-based in our regime, right? So we vote for our representatives and then they have a kind of right to legislate for us. But children don't vote for their parents and they don't vote for their teachers. And in fact, their behavior often suggests that they, if they had a vote, would not vote for these people. And so it's very difficult for us to kind of square that with our political, our sort of larger political commitments to liberalism. And whereas progressive pedagogy seems more in line with those commitments.
Yeah, good. And so that's a good transition into kind of the frame of your book, which takes up, well, what I've just mentioned, which is this idea of the logic of congruence, which effectively, you know, the point, I take it, as you were saying, has to do with the authority over children and liberalism, right? So in the liberal regime, authority is suspect, as you say. So, but the question is, how do we have authority over children? Children are different than adults. So how should we think about the authority? Should the authority be congruent with the authority that we have over adults or not? And so maybe you just take up that notion of the logic of congruence, sort of where that, you know, what the case for it is, who the figures are that are associated with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a really intuitive way that congruence makes sense. And that's sort of the reason that we're inclined towards it, right? Which is that we have this assumption that the way you raise a child is sort of practice for being an adult, right? So if you want a child to respect liberty and equality, you should raise them with liberty and equality, right? So you should treat them as an equal within the family, and you should give them freedom within the family of the sort that, as much as possible, that you would give to a fellow adult. And that in practicing this sort of liberty and equality in these, you know, one of the contemporary democratic theorists, Mira Levinson, calls it protected spaces of the home and of the school. They can sort of make mistakes, but learn from them. And then, you know, eventually by the time they reach the age of majority, they will be well-practiced liberal Democrats in a certain sense. And that is very intuitive. What's not intuitive is to say that we should, you know, subordinate children. We should exercise even, you know, extreme degrees of authority over them in the hope that one day they'll suddenly be free. That's, I think, very puzzling to people. So that's the non-congruent approach. And so the logic of congruence is intuitive. And I think that's why it has been very successful in the 19th and 20th centuries. But what's interesting is that Locke and Rousseau, when they're trying to think through this problem at sort of the beginning of liberalism, don't think that that's actually going to lead to liberty and equality in adults, that kind of education that is just a matter of practicing citizenship, practicing adult citizenship at a young age, is not actually going to result in the kind of adult citizenship that liberalism needs. And they see this kind of because they're opponents are a different set of people that we've largely forgotten, which is the absolutists of the early modern period. So Jean Bodin, Thomas Hobbes, Robert Filmer. And what they see in absolutism is actually congruence, that's the great sort of insight of early modern absolutism, is that if you want to create absolute monarchies, usually, although Hobbes is more complicated on that question, but absolute sovereignty, then what you need to do is reorganize the family so that it better models the absolutist state. And so starting with Bodin, you get this argument that fathers need to get the power of right of life and death, which is in the Roman law that had been abolished by Christian states, back over their children. They need to treat their children as though they are essentially absolute lords over them. And that experience of growing up under fathers who are absolute fathers will prepare children to be absolutist subjects to an absolutist sovereign. And so in their opposition to this understanding of the regime and the relationship between the family and the state, Locke and Rousseau also become opponents of congruence because they see that this is not the way to raise people for liberty.
Yeah, I love this, the idea that you know, the logic of congruence is a kind of illiberal logic, right? Essentially, that you know, if you're going to extend that extend that logic across all of society, it's to cohere with the sovereign rule of the country. This is a form of illiberalism, and that's if liberalism involves a kind of plurality, individuality, you know, that I mean, this is a very interesting move. I wish I had this move of yours when I was a discussant, I think, on a panel years ago, in which a critical theorist sort of made the claim that we treat children unjustly because we don't, you know, they're essentially voiceless members of society, right? That they're subject to parental rule. You know, parents vote on their behalf, so kids don't have the rule. So it was an argument that essentially extends the sort of the right to the suffrage of minors, right? And so that was
a moment in the 1970s, the child liberation movement, which was a sort of extreme version of the logic of congruence, right? Which was, I mean, it comes on the heels of these other sort of liberation movements in the United States. It comes on the heels of civil rights and the sexual revolution and all of these things. And you have people like John Holt writing these books saying, well, children are essentially treated as, you know, servants, and they have no rights, and they should be liberated. And we should give them the vote at an early age, and we should give them autonomy. And it makes sense if you think that everybody is a liberal subject and everybody is equal and everybody is free. There's a difficulty of having a sort of cutoff where you say, but below this age, we treat you all as totally subordinate. And I think it's not just that congruence is illiberal because the illiberals did it, right? I mean, we say the absolutists are illiberal and they did congruence, and therefore, you know, liberalism can't be congruent. There's a sort of another step that Locke and Rousseau saw that actually Hobbes is the first to see, which is that you could do congruence in liberalism. It doesn't on its face, you know, fall apart. It's the problem is where authority comes from in liberalism and what sovereignty is in liberalism. So it sort of makes sense for the absolutists to say, well, we're going to raise children to learn how to be subjects. and we're going to raise them in subjection so that they can practice subjection effectively as adults. But the difficulty with liberalism is that, and this is very clear in Locke, that the real sovereign is public opinion. And so when you say, well, we're going to raise children to practice liberty and equality, what you're really saying is we're going to subject children to public opinion from the very beginning. And the difficulty is that the child is not really capable of freedom after an education like that, right? That's where there's a sort of orthogonal element in liberalism, which is that liberalism liberates public opinion. And Hobbes sees that first, which is why he has a sovereign who has to control opinion. And Hobbes is very sort of optimistic that that's possible, that if you can, you know, demolish all of these intermediary associations, if the sovereign can control the church, then the sovereign can control language, and then the sovereign can control thought. And then we can stamp out dissent at the roots. And that way you won't have this problem of public opinion being something separate from what the sovereign wants it to be. But Locke first and then Rousseau sees that that's really not going to work, that dissent is going to come anyway. And so what we have to do to deal with opinion is, in a sense, free it, right? We have to have free speech. We have to have religious toleration. We have to allow people to be wrong in public. But if we are going to have a public realm in which we permit public opinion sort of free reign, we have to protect children from that public realm. Because if we expose them to it too early, we are going to foreclose the possibility of sort of real intellectual freedom, the ability to think for yourself, for them. And so that's why they end up in this position of denying or rejecting the logic of congruence, because they see that children are extremely susceptible to public opinion in a way that would actually foreclose their autonomy if we subjected them to it too early.
Yeah, that's great. So let's dig into some of this. You discuss first, you know, as you say, the logic of congruence in Jean Bodin's theory of sovereignty, which sort of emerged out of, in response to, you know, kind of the anarchy of authority in the feudal system, you know, the need to establish some kind of rational, impersonal rule to begin modernity. I mean, you're welcome to sort of expand on that if you want. I was curious for you to kind of deepen your account of Hobbes' response to Bodin, because I find that it's a very interesting way that Hobbes already sees some of the cracks or the difficulties that emerge out of this view of absolutist sovereignty, particularly as it relates to the family, that the family could be a kind of threat to sovereign rule. So could you develop that?
Yeah, I mean, Hobbes obviously is a great genius who sees a lot of things. And so he, in a way, adopts Bodin's sovereignty theory and extends it. And that's what you see in Leviathan and De Cive and all of his writings, is this sort of extension of Bodin's idea of sovereignty, which is that you need to have a power in the state that has sort of final say. And, you know, Bodin attributes various marks of sovereignty to it, like the pardon power and, you know, the ability to declare war and things like that. But fundamentally, it's the sort of final say in politics, in a regime. And so Hobbes adopts that, and he does think that that's the right way to conceive of politics, that they're everywhere, there has to be a sovereign. But the problem is that Bodin's mechanism of cultivating subjects for this sovereign, which is to create an absolutist family in which the father has this ultimate power over his children, including the power to kill them if he wants to, it poses a kind of threat to the sovereign, because now we have over the child two competing sovereigns. And the whole idea of sovereignty is that it is absolute and indivisible. And so it's strange to say that a father has the power of life and death over you, as does your sovereign. And in a way that creates a logical dilemma, it also creates a kind of a dilemma of loyalty, which is that the way that Baudin depicts the family, it seems like it's going to be terrible and your father's just going to be trying to kill you. And so you would hate that. But actually Baudin thinks that that's not really a danger, which is why it's perfectly safe to bring back the right of life and death, because basically parents love their children and they don't want to kill them. They want, you know, what is best for them. And so we don't have to worry if we reestablish this, you know, patria potestas in the law, because fathers won't be just like mass killing their children. But if it is the case that families actually, fathers love their children and families love each other, then you have this sort of competing loyalty to your family that would preclude you from giving your full loyalty to the sovereign. And that's what Hobbes is worried about. And Hobbes is worried about this at the level of the family and at every other intermediary association, that competing loyalties make it impossible for you to be a complete subject of the sovereign, right? And to take the sovereign's word for everything, which is in part what you're supposed to do. And so, you know, for him, you have, he sort of gives this very, he gives two accounts of the family. He says, well, there's this, or two accounts of the way that the regime comes into being, sovereignty comes into being. There's natural sovereignty. And then there's the artificial commonwealth, or the commonwealth by establishment or convention. And so the one account of the family he gives is a kind of Baudinian account in which, you know, we are subject to our fathers. That's the family is the first state in a certain sort of way. And fathers have absolute power. But the artificial commonwealth is one in which we all come together and out of fear of each other, set up this other sovereign who then has absolute power over us. And when we do that, all previous loyalties and associations are abolished, including the family. And so in a way, what he does is he establishes the family on the model of the natural commonwealth, and he makes it terrible. And that's what you're supposed to learn from the family, that by giving the father all of this power, or claiming that the father has all of this power, your experience of growing up under this essentially paternal despotism will make you want to live under an indirect sovereign, an impersonal sovereign, who's not up in your life every single day, you know, ordering you around and punishing you for every indiscretion, who is very far away, who creates laws and who doesn't really sort of interfere in your life. And in a way, what he does is he sets up this natural family with this kind of paternal sovereign as an experiential alternative to having this distant sovereign by institution who doesn't care at all about your life. And you will see that you prefer this distant sovereign from your own experience. And so he breaks the loyalty to the family. That's what he's interested in using the family for. So he does have a kind of logic of congruence, but it's a logic of congruence that's supposed to show you why all natural relations are dangerous and bad, and why you should ultimately be loyal to the sovereign, who is, if not totally impartial, at least pretty neutral about your life. And so there's a kind of greater freedom almost in the absolute sovereignty that Hobbes wants to set up, this sovereignty by institution, than you would have under this natural sovereignty in which we take the father to be a kind of absolute despot over us. So Hobbes is very interesting. And one of the reasons he wants to break our loyalty to the family is precisely because of this problem of the power of opinion. That opinion spreads in through these kinds of loyalty networks, right? They're your loyalties to your church, to your family, to your guild, to all of these feudal institutions that would otherwise compete with a centralized sovereign authority. And so we have to break all of them and turn everybody's eyes sort of only to the sovereign, and then allow the sovereign to sort of control public opinion in that way, by breaking down all of the alternative places where public opinion can be formed and disseminated.
So we want the absolutist sovereign, the Leviathan, in Hobbes' view, because it depends on a certain view of how parental authority will be exercised, right? So it's not, Hobbes has a different view, so that parental authority is a kind of tyranny rather than, you know, a loving, you know, kind of partnership,
right?
Is that right? So that in other words, you know, so when you achieve the Leviathan, you can actually find yourself making possible or setting the groundwork for an actual loving parental relationship, right? Because
Hobbes doesn't believe in loving families. There's no love. The way he designs the family in the Commonwealth, right? He has the family before the Commonwealth and the family after the social contract. And the family before the Commonwealth is purely force, right? It's whoever is the strongest takes over everybody else. So, you know, the mother is actually the first sovereign over the child, because she's the only one who knows who the child's parents actually are. But very quickly, she's overtaken by some man to whom she subordinates herself and her child. And then that creates a kind of tiny commonwealth. But that for Hobbes, that's not a sufficient sort of number of people for a commonwealth because they can't defend themselves. So then they subordinate themselves to some stronger person until you've amassed enough families under some sort of head that you can defeat enemies. And for Hobbes, that's the sort of standard of a commonwealth, right? Otherwise, it's just a group. So that's the natural state in which we are totally subordinated by fear of our sovereign, right? Whoever is the strongest person over us, that's who we're afraid of. But then there's this alternative where you create this commonwealth by institution. And now it's our fear of each other that is motivating us. And then once that's created, in a way, the natural family is abolished and reinstituted at the sovereign's discretion. He doesn't have to have families if he doesn't want to, but it's convenient in a way in Hobbes's argument to have the family, because the family is an educative institution which constantly reminds us about why we wanted to leave the state of nature, right? Because if you don't have the experience of the state of nature anymore because you're born into a commonwealth, it might seem kind of tempting to be free from this kind of rule. And one of Hobbes's great insights is that nobody likes to be ruled. They have to be shown that the alternatives are worse. And so we don't have this kind of visceral experience anymore of, you know, nasty, brutish, and short life in the state of nature. But what we do have is our parents. And if they're terrible to us, then we remember that's the state of nature, right? It's actually family life that replicates the state of nature and educates us about why we wanted to leave it and why we're grateful for the sovereign. Because even though he's absolute, he's less meddlesome than the kind of natural father that we would have encountered in the state of nature. And so the family is not a loving family. I mean, Hobbes never says you can, but if you follow his sort of psychology in Leviathan, loving your children isn't really going to get you anywhere. There's no real incentive to do that. They're not going to be grateful for it, or you can't guarantee their gratitude, and you're not going to get anything good out of it. And so what you're going to learn from having parents is basically how hard it is to control subjects so that you don't start to get ambitions about being the sovereign, which you might have if you think I'm a strong person who could fend for myself in the state of nature and even get some people under me to support me. Well, good luck with your children. That's one experience of how difficult it is to rule. And on the flip side, for the children, it's an experience of how unpleasant it is to be ruled directly and personally by a natural sovereign, and how much better it is to have this kind of indirect, impersonal, almost bureaucratic sovereignty over you that sort of leaves you alone in your private life. And so that's what the family does for Hobbes. It's kind of reconstituted on these artificial grounds as an educational institution that is a constant reminder to those of us who've never personally experienced the state of nature about what the state of nature might be like. And in that respect, it's pretty bad. And you know, there, you know, you can get along with people, but there's always a kind of fear relationship that circulates through the family that's supposed to replicate the state of nature.
Yeah, that's great. Because I was wondering, you know, why would the Leviathan constitute families at all? What is their purpose as an educative institution? And that's helpful what you say. It's not because there's a natural affection of love that the kids then would trust the parents when the parents tell them to obey the sovereign, but because the kids are, it's a reminder that the kids should obey the sovereign is something better. But, you know, so but what's in it for the parents then in the Hobbesian?
Well, very little, right?
So why would they have kids? First of all, yeah.
Why would they have kids is the question.
Yeah.
Educating just happens by being alive, by existing in this society. Yeah. So the question is, why do you have the kids? And it seems, I mean, this is a problem for Locke too. There isn't really an incentive if you follow the arguments of the state of nature to have kids. And so for Hobbes, the answer is you have kids because you have this desire to rule, because you're conceited. And all of us are like this, or at least he does say there are some people who just don't, who sort of see through the desire to rule and see that it actually endangers them. But most people don't. Most people have these ambitions. And so having children is an experience that shows them the wrongness of these ambitions, right? That they ought not to want to rule people, because actually ruling is very difficult and it imperils them. And so you have kids just because you have kids. It's you don't really think it through. And for those people who do think it through, like maybe Hobbes himself, who never got married or had any kids, right? They don't need that kind of tuition, right? They don't need to be taught that way. They can sort of philosophically understand that actually trying to rule endangers you more than it benefits you. But most people don't have that kind of philosophical insight. And so they learn through experience. And that experience is the experience of raising fractious children who are constantly trying to rebel against their rule. And so that they see that this isn't worth it. And Locke sort of presents this problem differently. I mean, Locke just says, well, you, in the state of nature, you don't even intend to have children. You just intend to gratify your sexual desires. And there you go, a child comes out of that. But for both of them, there is this difficulty in justifying having children at all, given what the sort of basic human motivations that they describe are in the state of nature, right? This desire for self-preservation, in a way, would disincline you towards saddling yourself with the responsibility for another person.
Good. So let's turn to Locke, because you have two very substantial chapters on Locke. And of course, Locke has a well-known critique of Hobbes and absolutism, which we're welcome to sort of go into your account of Locke and limited governments and the limitations of sovereignty that Locke puts into early modern thought. One of the things that I found most interesting, though, about your account is the way that you reveal Locke's worry about the authority of public opinion, which comes into play and really sort of remains as a sort of troublesome form of authority, even after one would restrict any kind of visible forms of power in society. So maybe you could discuss, talk about Locke's view of his skepticism of authority in general, and the problem of public opinion in particular, and maybe where it emerges in the text. You talk a fair bit about the essay concerning human understanding.
Yeah, I mean, so I think, it's pretty well known that Locke starts out sounding kind of Hobbesian in his earliest writings, which are not published, he writes these two tracts on government that basically just endorse absolute sovereignty and the power of the sovereign magistrate to determine, religious questions and things like that. And as his sort of early writings in the 1660s sort of progress to the 1670s, different versions of them sort of evince this growing skepticism that actually the sovereign is going to effectively be able to do this, right? It's not that he thinks that the theory is necessarily wrong or that it would be bad if the sovereign could do it. It's just that he seems to think he has, these essays on toleration and the two tracts on government, in which, as he's revising them, he seems increasingly skeptical that actually the sovereign can effectively dictate public opinion. And then the problem seems to be that if he can't, the situation is much worse than if we allow public opinion to sort of flow freely and be unconstrained by sort of the magistrate's effort to control it. And this kind of comes to a head in the essay concerning human understanding, which he writes many drafts of. But by the final draft, you have this argument about the power of, he calls it variously fashion, custom, and opinion, where he says, men are actually governed by that. That's the real sovereign. They're governed by that more than by anything else. And, he has a quote that says, they little listen to the laws or even their religion. So everything is in a way subordinated to whatever, their company believes, which is to say their friends or the people around them. And given the power of that sort of persuasive mechanism, whatever it is, if it can't be controlled, it seems that the efforts, what he sees as the efforts to control it, this is the argument he makes in the essays on toleration, are actually much more destructive than just letting it sort of loose, because the efforts to control it result in more rebelliousness, right? People who are sort of inflamed by opinion take very poorly to their sovereign's efforts to try to change their opinions, especially with regard to religion. And they take up arms, they start wars over it. Whereas if we just let them be, right, there's less destruction to be had from letting their sort of wrong opinions burn at a low sort of, at sort of low wattage, rather than forcing them to sort of strike up a conflagration in a confrontation with the sovereign. And so he he tries to figure out in the essay concerning human understanding, what, you know, how does opinion shape us? Where do we get our ideas from? Right. And then if it's the case that we're so centrally shaped by the ideas of the people around us rather than the truth, right? Rather than our own logical capacity to sort of reason through things, right? Rather than anything that our sovereign tells us we have to believe, then what is the possibility for knowing the truth? How would we become the kinds of people who could know the truth, who could sort of wade through this sea of opinion and try to figure out what is real? And so that's sort of, you know, is extended in his essay on education, that interest, that question of how can you discipline your mind in such a way that you can learn to see through opinion and fashion and custom and get to the truth? How can you bottom, as he calls it, bottoming your reasoning at the truth? So that becomes really his interest. I mean, it has political ramifications in the two treatises where he just tries to describe a government that would be complementary to the fact that opinion is probably uncontrollable by any central source. And then it has ramifications for his understanding of the family and of education, where he tries to describe what kind of education would be most helpful towards guiding a child towards this ability to bottom their reason, right? To be able to see through opinion and to see through fashion and actually get to the truth.
Yeah, you know, so I guess a question about this view of public opinion, because, you know, it's strange. It sounds to me almost like it's a, you know, it's a precursor to, you know, the sort of forms of critiques of mass society and public opinion, tyranny of the majority that you see in Tocqueville, where public opinion takes on this force that's sort of all encompassing. Although it's a little bit surprising, because I would expect at least maybe Locke to be alive to the possibility that, you know, public opinion, there's disagreements among fashion, right? So like different groups have different opinions about this fashion or that fashion. There's what a political scientist call it, you know, cross-cutting cleavages in society, where you have like, you know, you have two different geographical groups and then different religions cut across like those geographical groups. So I would expect, at least in Locke, being the empiricist that he is, that he might recognize the possibility, in other words, that public opinion is not a monolithic thing,
right?
But conflicts. So that, in other words, like, you know, you could actually presumably maybe let children free under that view, because they would encounter sort of conflicts in public opinion, so they wouldn't be mastered by them, but they could sort of dialectically work themselves through the conflicts and emerge free.
Yeah, except they have no reason. So that would be very difficult for them. He doesn't view, he's not a theorist of mass society in that sense, that public opinion is monolithic. There's definitely, I mean, he calls it, you know, the fashions of one's company. So there are many companies, right? I mean, you have your group of friends, your sort of, your neighborhood, your opinions are coming from maybe different places, and or at least there's different sources of them in one larger society. But the concerns that he has are twofold. One is, can they be controlled, unified, homogenized, in any way sort of directed by some overseeing power, right? Some kind of political, centralized political source. And that he thinks is impossible. Pluralism is here to stay, right? Pluralism is something that no government can really suppress. And the effort to suppress it has been extremely destructive and violent and undermines social stability much more than just letting this kind of pluralism exist, right? So that's one concern, is whether there's any kind of sovereign or political regime or political arrangement that can control and direct that opinion reliably. And then the second concern is that even though there are sort of competing opinions out there, how are we as individuals supposed to find the truth through them, right? They could all be wrong. The fact that there are 10 of them doesn't guarantee that there are 10 truths. There could still be zero truths among them. And so there's a question for politics that arises from this insight into public opinion that he has, the power of fashion. And then there's a question for sort of individual philosophical pursuit that arises from it, which is, how do you cut through all the opinion to get to the truth? And so I think, you know, he tries to answer the first set of questions in the second treatise, or you would say the two treatises on government, and also in the letters concerning toleration. And then the second question about individual truth seeking, he tries to answer in some thoughts concerning education, in the conduct of the understanding, which is a little short manual for sort of adults about mental discipline. So both of those are problems that arise just from the fact of a plurality of opinions that sort of dominates society.
Good. Yeah. So let's talk about some thoughts on education, which I gather from your description of the scholarship around that book that people read it differently. You know, some tend to read some thoughts as a kind of manual to prepare children for liberty as described in the, or liberty in a form of government as described in the second treatise. Other people, I guess this is more of the Foucauldian line, right? That it's a kind of education to restrict and take away freedom, to discipline the subject, as it were. Mm-hmm. What's your view between these two?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the Foucauldian approach is trying to sort of give a genealogy of the present. And so they see Locke as one of the sources of a kind of disciplinary social system that we live in today. And they particularly fixate on his use of habituation. But I think that they are misconstruing what the habituation is for. So, you know, he talks a lot in Thoughts Concerning Education about how important it is to habituate, especially young children, to various things. I mean, almost like a whole, you know, it's almost minutia how much, you know, stuff you're supposed to be habituated to. You know, you have to be habituated to cold water, having cold feet all the time. You have to be habituated to, you know, to going to bed early. You have to be habituated to having regular bowel movements. I mean, it's that specific. And so they see that as a kind of indoctrination that prepares you to be a liberal subject, that disciplines you, that sort of controls you and reproduces your parents essentially in you. And your parents are produced by their parents. And at some point, sort of liberalism is set in motion and it reproduces itself through this sort of education. And I think that that's not a correct reading of how Locke is using habituation, because if you look at the things he's habituating children to, and the things, the two exceptions he has to habituation in itself, you see that the habituation is all for things that they wouldn't naturally want to do. So you have to be habituated to like being cold and uncomfortable, which no child naturally wants to be. You have to be habituated to, you know, the regular bowel movements, for example. And if you think about the context of that, it's, you know, that's so you have to stop doing what you want to do. You have to stop playing or doing whatever is enjoyable and like go to the bathroom, which you never really want to do. Right. And then the other thing that you have to be habituated to is going to bed early. Again, that's something that children naturally don't want to do. They want to stay up late. They want to keep playing. They want to be engaged in whatever the family's doing late at night. And so if you look at every single one of the things that he is proposing the child be habituated in, all of them are things that cross the child's natural desires. And so we see sort of, if you look back at the essay concerning human understanding, his account of the will and desire, which are really central to this problem of how do you think through opinion and get to the truth, right? You have to be able to suppress your desire to follow fashion. You have to be able to sort of counter your desire to be liked by other people, which you will be if you agree with them, and you will be less so if you disagree with them. And so the whole project of the education is about training the child to counter their natural desires or to silence them or to sort of still them for a minute. Right, so that judgment can be exercised and they can stop and think, is this really what I should do? And then the will can redirect desire after that. And so you start with the young child who has, you know, not many thoughts, but many desires. And what you're doing is you're constantly teaching the child that it can suppress its desires, that it can counter its desires, that like, yes, it wants to eat the sweet cookie, but you take the sweet cookie away and it turns out it can survive without the sweet cookie. Or it wants to stay up late, but you force it to go to bed and it turns out you can survive that way, right? So that you see the non-necessity of your desires. And there's no way to do that for young children other than by having adults impose it on them, to substitute their wills, as Locke puts it, for the wills of the will of the child. And so that's what all this early education is about. It's about the substituting the will of the child with your will, the parent's will, in order to constantly counter the child's desires and show him that he can actually live without those things, that they're not necessities. And so the idea is you do that when they're young, so that when they're older, they can sort of take over that function themselves. When they've developed a strong enough will that they can silence their own desires, and that when they want the cookie and they're now old enough to just get it, they can stop themselves and say, you know, is this cookie good for me? Do I really want this cookie? And so habituation is actually a kind of counter habituation for Locke. It's about cutting off the development of habits that otherwise would form if you just allowed the child to pursue his desires, right? You would become habituated to staying up late. You would become habituated to eating really, you know, rich food. You would become habituated to being warm and comfortable, and you would be unable to face a situation in which that wasn't available to you later on. And so he thinks that's the real danger, is to get a child habituated, as you know, early on, to be unable to be flexible. So all the habituation is actually just the only mechanism available for a young child that doesn't have reason to get them to become flexible later in life. And when their own will and their own reason take over for the will and reason of their parents, they have this kind of strong will that's able to silence their desires at their disposal.
Right. Does he call it the suspending power of judgment in the essay concerning human understanding? Right. That idea, you know, because I was wondering if this is kind of a classical view of education where you sort of put reason above the passions, a lot, you know, reason disciplines the passions, but it's a little bit different of a psychology in that sense, that it's not necessarily reason. It's just a suspension of the actual, you know, deterministic causal process of the, you know, whatever kinds of Hobbesian passions are going on. It's just that ability to elevate the will above it.
Response to Hobbes. Right. That's right. And it is a response to Hobbes, who just says it's just one desire after another unto death. And so Locke says, well, that doesn't really account for how we experience our lives. Like, we don't experience our lives as being sort of a pre-programmed sort of, concession to desire after desire. It seems like sometimes we stop and think about it and choose something else. And so that's sort of what he puts into the essay as a stopgap against Hobbes. And then in the thoughts concerning understanding, that's exactly right. It is about, you know, the child can't reason, but it can build up its will. And then eventually, when reason is able to sort of take over, it will have the strong will at its disposal so that it can reason in that moment of suspended desire about what is good to do. Right. And that's how we're trying to get the child to autonomy.
So education is really about the will and not about reason. Is that right? Or is it about both?
Well, later on, as the child gets older, you introduce subjects, right? So like the second half of Some Thoughts Concerning Education, he talks about, you know, you teach geography and there's a whole discussion about whether you should teach Latin or not, or how you teach languages. So there are, you know, there is substance to the education. It's not just about disciplining the will. But I think it is really significant that for Locke, you know, half the book is really about disciplining a toddler effectively, right? And the physical development, the physical education of really very young children. And that is the sort of essential foundation for whatever the curriculum that you lay on top of it later on is. But he does think reason develops naturally. And so that's less of a concern in some sense than the will. The will is, in a sense, almost the real danger where you could really go wrong with education, because if you don't educate the will correctly, you get a kind of tyrannical will or a slavish will. Those are the two bad, you know, sort of the Aristotelian, you know, excess and deficiency, which is the super submissive will, where you have no sort of desires of your own. All the desires have been beaten out of you and you're just willing to submit to anything. And that's, of course, the sort of slavish temperament that he's afraid of. It would be obviously bad for liberalism. And then on the other hand, the sort of domineering will, where your desires are always gratified as a child. And so you get the sense that you could command people and get them to do your bidding. And that, of course, is a sort of tyrannical disposition, equally dangerous to the liberal regime.
Right. Great. And yeah, I mean, this is why at the end of the chapter, you call it a corrective to the excesses of liberalism. I find this interesting, you know, so it's not some thoughts isn't necessarily, you know, sort of just a preparatory manual to produce liberalism, but it's actually aware of the tendencies in liberalism that could actually undermine itself. And it's a sort of a correction of that. So that I found that fascinating. I mean, one of the dangers, of course, is what Locke calls, or you call, I'm not sure, the desire for domination, right? That's natural to human beings. So, you know, I mean, this is a natural desire. If we don't, if we're not habituated to sort of be able to suspend our will in the face of it, then it's going to lead to kind of tyranny. So how does Locke suggest addressing this desire?
So the desire for domination, I mean, this is something that Locke and Rousseau are both really interested in. And in a way, Rousseau sort of agrees with Locke that this is the danger. So the desire for domination, Locke says, is not exactly natural, like it's not spontaneous in us. But because civilized society has this surplus where people can give you all the things you want in a way, or all the things an infant wants, which is not very many things, and nature seems to bend to your will, because it's not real nature anymore, right? It's a kind of surplus to nature with all kinds of additional advantages that humans have created. Your first sort of insight will be that you can command other people. That's the first insight of the infant, right? Because whenever it cries, people do things for it. And so Locke is very worried about this because he seems to think that, you know, in a real state of nature, that wouldn't happen because there just wouldn't be enough to give to the child, that it would always have its desires satisfied, right? And if you think about, you know, chapter 5 of the second treatise on property, right? In the state of nature, you can't have spoilage. So you actually can never have surplus until you create money and overcome this problem. But in society, we have surplus. And so you could actually satisfy every single desire of an infant. And that would give the infant the sense that it is... It rules. It rules all the adults around it. And the way to counteract that is through this sort of regimen of denying its desires, right? So that, I mean, Locke says, when it cries, it's up to you, the adult, to determine, is this something that the child really needs, or is it crying out of a kind of fanciful want for something? And if it's something that the child really needs, of course, you don't deny the child food, you don't deny the child sleep, you don't deny the child its basic necessities, but anything beyond those necessities you have to deny. So that it learns that it doesn't have this kind of power over other people, that people don't do its bidding, that it doesn't control them. And then, you know, he says, but don't go too far, because if you deny every single desire, then the child's conclusion from this will be that all its desires are ineffectual. There's no point in having desires. You should just submit to whatever people do to you. And so that's the obvious sort of other problem, or the obverse problem of slavishness.
Yeah. So isn't, I mean, you quote a line, I don't know some thoughts all that well, but you quote a line where it says something like the kids need to see their parents as like the absolute Lord or some such thing. I mean, but how does that square with you, what you just said though? I mean, I find this a little bit confusing in the sense.
Yeah. That, I mean, it's very confusing, especially in relation to the second treatise where the whole argument is against absolutism. And so suddenly you have this account, oh, well, you should see your parents as the absolute Lord. But that's where authority, I think, comes in for Locke, right? That there is, if you leave the child to its own devices, it will be corrupted in a liberal society. It cannot be treated as an equal because it's not ready for that yet. So you have to impose authority. So all of this substituting of one's will, all of this determining which desires are desires of nature versus desires of fancy and all of that sort of thing, that's the exercise of adult authority. And it's extremely necessary to sort of the correct upbringing of a liberal subject, a liberal citizen. But there's a problem, which is if the child doesn't submit to your authority, right? So you can over-exercise your authority and, you know, force the child to submit too much. And that's the slavishness problem. But there is also this problem that some children, they don't want to submit. They want to exercise their own wills and they want to pursue their desires. And so, you know, he's very much against corporal punishment, except for in this case of where the child will not recognize your authority. Right. So, he's against beatings as a sort of regular mechanism of disciplining a child. Right. So he says you should use shame and praise in order to discipline a child under regular circumstances. And the reason that those would work is because the child recognizes your authority and wants to please you. And so there's no need to beat the child, which is also destructive for other reasons, because, in fact, if the child adores you, then just your sort of, you know, disappointment with the child will be enough, will be sort of enough of a rebuke to get them to change their behavior, because they're going to behave in such a way as to please you, and they will avoid the things that they think will cause them to feel ashamed or cause you to be displeased. But if you can't establish that relationship of authority, because for whatever reason it hasn't worked, which the reason that Locke gives is because you've been coddling the child, usually the mother, it's the mother's fault for coddling the child too much. And as a result, she loses the authority over the child. The child isn't really trying to please her anymore, because now the child feels that he's in control of her actually, and he can get his desires from her. Then you have to resort to corporal punishment, and even quite extreme corporal punishment. He has this like section of describing a mother beating her daughter, I think he says something like 8 times consecutively in one morning, until you get that rebelliousness, that the sense that this person is not an authority over you, out. And only then will the rest of the education work. The whole thing is really premised on children loving their parents, children wanting to please their parents voluntarily. And that's why this relationship of praise and blame can be so effective with them, and you don't need to resort constantly to spanking them or whatever.
Good. Okay. Yeah. So I was curious about this picture in a way, because it's, I mean, thinking about this sort of more, you know, I don't know what I think you call it at one point, sort of authoritarian in quotation marks view of education. And yeah, I mean, taking that term with a grain of salt, the, I'm curious about sort of, you know, how Hobbes would respond to Locke's view of education. Cause it seems like, well, in any case, it relies on a different view of the parent-child relationship, that it's more loving than the Hobbesian relationship. But it seems to me that if you're in a household where the parents are consumed by this desire for domination, wouldn't it actually be better if the kids are liberated from parental authority these kids who are sort of in extremely restrictive kinds of households, and their will is constrained and become like the servile will that you were talking about. Isn't it better if, you know, the kids can find liberation by escaping the household? I guess does Locke have a kind of, you know, maybe exceptions for that, for the sort of, when you come across a more Hobbesian type of family?
Yeah, I mean, well, he's not, this is not a political treatise in the sense that he's telling the government what to do about forming families, right? So he's just advising parents about how to raise their children, assuming that they're interested in doing it the right way, right? He says, you know, the parents who are willing to cross, you know, willing to defy custom and things like that. So in a sense, that question's hard to answer from what the text is, right? Which is not really an argument about the state's responsibility for families. But it does, I mean, the way that he describes this education is actually also an education for ill-educated parents, right? Because to do what Locke is requiring of you to your children requires you to discipline yourself quite a bit if you weren't already disciplined in this way, right? So he doesn't assume parents are all Lockeans. He sort of assumes parents are normal people with normal passions. And, you know, these are sort of, you know, this is the gentry, the lower gentry. They come from society. These are, you know, they're people with leisure, people with wealth, who are, you know, maybe not the most self-disciplined people in English society. But if you are trying to carry out the program that Locke is suggesting, you will have to discipline yourself, because first of all, you know, one of the things he points to is the power of imitation, that children are always imitating their parents. And if they really adore you, then they're obviously going to imitate you more readily. So now you've got to stop being the kind of person who you don't want your children to imitate, right? At the very least in front of them. Well, it turns out that you're in front of them all the time, because like you're going to be secluded in your country estate for basically the entire duration of your children's upbringing. They're not supposed to be taken really. I mean, they're not supposed to be sent to school. So you've got to educate them at home. You want to avoid company that you can't control. So maybe going to London is not going to be the thing to do. And, you know, so you're sort of controlling this entire environment, but you're trapped in it. And so, and you're there with your children all the time. And so if you are the kind of person, or you do the kind of things that you wouldn't want your children to imitate, you have to stop. So you have to become the kind of person that you want them to imitate. You have to control your own desires And so you are strengthening your will in the process. And if you coddle them, right? I mean, the thing is, you know, if you're too indulgent, as Lock thinks mothers tend to be, then you run the risk of having to beat them, which is like the last thing you want to do if you're an indulgent parent, right? And if you're too severe, then you have to live with the consequences of that too, right? Because you're just stuck there with your kids on your estate in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it's not really the middle of nowhere. I guess you have, it's a neighborhood, but it's a rural neighborhood. And so you're living with the consequences of all of your bad parenting decisions. And so if your desire is just to dominate your children and you create these sort of submissive limp children out of it, right, you're not going to enjoy spending the rest of their youth with them, but you're stuck there, right? So in a way, that the way that Locke structures this education ends up being an education for parents, and it ends up having to shape the way that parents themselves are and behave in order that they can be more effective educators of their children.
That's great. So let's move on to Rousseau. It's interesting. I mean, it strikes me reading through your account of Rousseau, one of the things that you're doing in the book is bringing Rousseau somewhat close to Locke. There are a lot of similarities that, you know, that are sort of unexpected. This discussion about as we were just talking about, the domination by public opinion is a good example here, which is of course maybe more familiar to readers of Rousseau than to Locke. The idea that, you know, the civil or the bourgeois man sort of lives outside of himself and the thoughts of others. And there's also the similarity at the end of the day. I mean, quite surprising to me, where you talk about, you know, that the effectual truth of Rousseau's form of education is actually Locke. So I want to get there, but, you know, first to sort of, start where you did with the account of Rousseau on public opinion. One of the, I guess, the first place that you see divergences from Locke in your account is that Rousseau is much more alive to the possibility that government can control public opinion, and say in the form of the censor and in the social contract, for example, that mores are much more malleable in Rousseau's view, or at least controllable. Maybe you can talk about that, sort of why Rousseau was able to break with Locke on that point, what the significance is.
Yeah, I mean, Rousseau is more optimistic. I mean, he gives us a mechanism, especially in the letter to D'Alembert, where he talks about this effort to ban dueling. And he goes through all of the steps that the French tried to take to ban dueling. And they had, you know, you have to figure out how to model this with the right sorts of role models. So you have these like generals, these sort of retired generals or whatever, who are supposed to be this council that determines the, you know, these questions. You can't let the king do it himself. But ultimately it's a failure, right? So he has this sort of, and then the social contract is where he brings up the legislator or the lawgiver and the censors. And, you know, the lawgiver in a way shapes mores, but in a pre-verbal, deeply primitive sort of way, right? I mean, different scholars have tried to figure out what exactly the lawgiver is doing. And I think one of the more convincing accounts, Chris Kelly makes this argument, is that what he's doing is actually, it's music that he's using to teach the people, because in a way they don't even have a language yet. It's so primitive, you know, the moment at which this people is formed. So to the degree that mores are controlled, they're like quite vague. There's sort of fundamental principles of the people, but they're also, in being so primitive and fundamental and even pre-verbal, they're not very specific. And then, so once you create in the social contract, you create the state, and then you have these censors who are more overt in their sort of control of mores. And that works in a kind of ideal republic. And then it collapses even in the social contract. All of the institutions decay by the end. And then he's sort of giving these accounts of what kinds of band-aids you can put on these institutions as they start to decay. He thinks it's possible. And he certainly is much more concerned with the role of personal direct authority even in impersonal states. And he thinks that liberals like Hobbes and Locke have gone wrong to think that you could have a purely impersonal form of government, and that there will always be personal authorities. And we have to take account of those personal authorities in order to understand how people's souls are formed, because they're really not formed by impersonal authorities. So in that sense, he's more optimistic because he does think that you can have these authorities within states and that they can be salutary. But he doesn't really give any examples of how of it working ever in history. And
well, what about Poland? I mean, I think about the Poland example, you're right, the nation building, you know, sort of education to a certain kind of character of the people, right?
Again, that's ideal, right? He's proposing what the Polish should do, right? And they should have these, you know, this kind of public education, and they should have these contests. You know, there was something about, you know, like raising beets or something, like you can get rewards for that, you know, public honor. But that's all speculative. It's all a proposal for what you ought to do. It's certainly not what happens in Poland. And it's, you know, he doesn't give a historical account of the control of mores other than Sparta, right? Would be a sort of extreme, you know, in this ideal ancient republic that we know very little about, it worked. And it worked in Rome, to a degree, sort of at the height of Rome's virtue. But in modern times, we don't really have an effective control of mores. We have what we have are women, and women control mores, but women have to voluntarily become virtuous in order to control the mores of men. And that's something that's very hard to centrally legislate. It's something that occurs sort of from the bottom up in society. And so, you know, what he's doing in Emile, I mean, he has sort of different ways of addressing political problems. So he has one approach, which is sort of the ideal republic. Let me schematize the ideal republic for you and what it would require. But Emile is different in the sense that Emile is concerned with the reality of a sort of modern commercial society and how should we live under real modern commercial conditions in order to attain some kind of happiness, given the corruption that sort of surrounds us. And so that's a kind of different way of approaching the question. So he does think it's possible, ideally, to control opinion to some degree, never completely. I mean, he says opinion is the mistress of the world, and there's nobody who can really control her. But you can make efforts to control opinion, but it's not, I mean, he's closer to Locke than Hobbes in thinking it's very difficult and you shouldn't count on it.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Cause I initially had the thought that Rousseau's admission that controlling public opinion is possible actually might have a consequence that he need not rely as much on families in order to insulate children from public opinion, because if you have government sort of, you know, joining in the task, then that not need not rely, you know, put so much onus on the family. But it sounds like, in your view, Rousseau actually, since it kind of redounds back to the role of women, after all, it sounds like family actually has to bear all the burden.
Yeah, well, I mean, so in the ideal virtuous republic, you strangle the private sphere. I mean, that comes through in the Constitution of Poland. It's, you know, the essay on political economy and the social contract. You see that, like, when he's trying to describe a kind of ideal virtuous republic, yes, the virtue is public. And so you have only public education, right? You have to take children away from their parents and make sure that they're educated in these public institutions. And you diminish as much as possible the role of the family, because the family then creates these kind of competing loyalties again that we have to try to avoid when we have a really virtuous republic. And, you know, that sort of following Plato, following, you know, Plutarch's Life of Lycurgus, right? That argument is not, in some sense, new. The question is only, is it possible, right? So in these ideal states, that is what he recommends. What's really interesting is that when he writes about non-ideal states in the letter to D'Alembert, in Emile, in Julie, it's the family that does everything. The family is the only recourse, because the public sphere has been corrupted. And so you can't count on anything good coming from the public sphere. You can't count on public education. All you have left then is the private sphere. And so all virtue transmission is really private. And then the family becomes really central to sort of the correct education or the best education that's possible under these corrupt conditions.
Good. Yeah. So let's talk about the Emile, because, you know, it's really, you know, where the meat of your discussion is on education. And your discussion of Mill has the same character as what we were just talking about in the context of government, that there's sort of Rousseau's ideal theory, and then the, you know, what's practicable under, you know, modern corrupt conditions. So, so maybe you could discuss, I mean, Prusine, you know, take some of the high points in terms of your view of how Rousseau critiques Locke's view or vision of education in Mill.
Yeah, I mean, he both critiques and kind of affirms them, right? So he sees philosophical problems with Locke's argument. So the first problem is Locke's political theory is based on consent. And you can only consent, only those who have reason can consent. And so it's strange, according to Rousseau, that he would have an education in which he creates a form of rule over people who don't consent, which is to say children, right? So there's this problem in the way that Locke conceives of his education, which is he imposes authority over children at birth, basically, without any possibility of them consenting to that authority. And yet his entire political philosophy argues that no authority is legitimate unless it's consented to. And so what he does in Emile is to try to raise a child, or to sort of give an account of what it would be like to raise a child, so that he actually consents to parental or tutorial authority, you know, reasonably and fully. And that would require holding off asking him to consent until adolescence, because that would be the first point at which he would be at the age of reason and able to consent. So you have to raise him in such a way as he feels that there is no authority over him. And so what the tutor does is like these very elaborate orchestrations, you know, his whole life is like the environment is totally controlled because he can at no point feel somebody else's will governing him, because that would sort of break the Lockean logic of consent is, you know, the only basis of legitimate authority is consent. If you're too young to consent, then we have to rule you in these other ways where you feel that you're not being ruled, but in effect, you are completely ruled. And so that sort of, you know, books 1 through 3 of Emile is this, you know, effort to sort of orchestrate his entire childhood in these extremely elaborate and improbable ways so that he learns the lessons he's supposed to learn, but he never feels like anybody is forcing him to learn anything or forcing him to do anything. So that's the first critique, is so you need to get consent at adolescence rather than consent in infancy, because that's impossible. So that's part of what he's criticizing, is that Locke has education backwards, because you've got to start with sort of, you know, a non-consenting person and get them to consent, show them, argue to them, persuade them that they should consent rather than assuming their consent. And then the other concern that he has, I mean, he thinks there are several sort of hypocritical points in Locke, you know, about generosity, for example. You can't teach generosity by giving people stuff to give to other people, because then that just tells them that they're going to be rewarded with more stuff if they give their stuff away, right? So there's all these sort of hypocritical lessons that are being taught there. And then, you know, in the end, the problem seems to be that Locke, you know, Locke is preparing a child to be free by enslaving him. And it works, but it doesn't work in theory. It works in practice, but not in theory. And so what Emile is trying, or what Rousseau is trying to do with Emile, is to show how you prepare a person for freedom by letting them be free in childhood. And it turns out that freedom requires a whole bunch of effective authority, but unacknowledged authority. And then, you know, we have book 5 on Sophie and Emile, which inverts everything that goes on with Emile and returns in a way to the Lockean paradigm.
Yeah, and can you elaborate on that? Because it's interesting you say sort of, you know, Locke doesn't work in theory, but he works in practice. So how is it, why does it work in practice? Because you might expect, again, I mean, this sort of, yeah, I mean, Rousseau sets up at the beginning of Emile this sort of the government by necessity versus government by the will, or whatever it is that he calls it. And he chooses that government by necessity rather than the government by the will for the reasons that you mentioned. Well, you know, I mean, this is, Rousseau is worried that the government by the human will activates all those kinds of feverish worries about amor prop and creates all sorts of perverse consequences. So I guess, I mean, this is why it's confusing to me on the, you know, Rousseau's view, why it is that he would then come ultimately to think that Locke's view actually can be effectual, even though, you know, he set out to say that kind of model is creates a bourgeois who's not like denatured or natural man, but nothing in between, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the ultimate conclusion of Emile is that you can't have a natural man in society. I mean, Emile's education is just a failure. And so, well, what's the alternative? The alternative is to be a slightly denatured Lockean. And so, I mean, in the sense that Locke's education works, it works if you can sort of take the child out of society, right, to someplace relatively isolated so that, you know, the power of opinion and fashion is not bearing down on the child all the time. So he's not so tethered to public opinion, right? That his amour propre is not so sort of inflamed by his childhood. But yes, it will be activated in his childhood. And then, you know, Locke criticizes this idea that parents are going to be the dispensers of praise and blame, right? That goes back to one of his sort of fundamental critiques of Locke, which is that the child should be amoral. It doesn't make sense that Locke, I mean, Locke's account of where morals come from and morality comes from doesn't seem to, you know, you're imposing moral views on an infant, essentially. It's not capable yet of knowing them. And so the idea that you should set up the parents as dispensers of praise and blame assumes that a child can understand morality at that age, which Locke supposedly claims he cannot. So that's another sort of direction in which Rousseau's critique of Locke takes off in books 1 through 3 is how can we teach a child without introducing any morality until adolescence. But the reality is if the parents are decent people, which Sophie's parents are sort of shown depicted as, they're sort of very upstanding moral people. If those are the moral influences from the beginning and other influences are kept at bay, right? Or just sort of the child is shielded from them, it could work. You would have sort of your amour propre inflamed a little bit, but it would only be to please your parents. You would only be comparing yourself to your parents. You wouldn't be comparing yourself to this larger society to which you haven't really been exposed yet. And so even though it's philosophically imperfect in the sense that it continues to contain these contradictions about the development of morality, about consent, about domination, in effect, it could work to produce a person who is relatively well-balanced, right, between sort of their desires and their capacities. And especially if you pair it with marriage, right? Because that sort of fixes the problem of adolescence. And so it's a tenuous solution. And Rousseau is actually quite emphatic that it's tenuous. I mean, he at various points mocks marriage in book 5, right? And he says it's unbelievable that people would believe this institution is going to save them, right? Given how fickle love is. And then he sort of sets it as the solution at the same time. And then, you know, if you look at the sequel, Emile et Sophie, right? It all falls apart. And so there's no point at which Rousseau, you know, is a propagandist for marriage, right? Or tries to diminish the tenuousness of this solution to bourgeois dividedness. But as a tenuous solution, it is a solution. And it's a practicable solution that's available to most people. Whereas the alternative solutions, which is either going back to this kind of virtue, republic of virtue, right, like Sparta or Rome, requires a wholesale revolution in society, which is very difficult to coordinate. And then, you know, on the other side, the solution of just leaving society, being the solitary, is going to be very difficult for most people because they're just not capable of being solitaries. And so for most people who are not going to be able to organize a society-wide revolution and who are not going to be able to go and live on an island in the middle of France, I guess, marriage is the solution.
Corsica. You could go to Corsica.
Yeah. I think, well, he does his botany, you know, I think he's in France, right? Like, but on an island. So, you know, for regular people, you know, intelligent, regular people who do want to get themselves out of this sort of dividedness that they feel, you know, being pulled between their desires and their duties. This kind of education that Sophie gets is going to fortify them, even though it cannot guarantee them the unity and the happiness that they seek.
Okay. I mean, I think I can see that, you know, that the book 5 holds the practicable solution. I don't know. So I'm still skeptical in part because the rest of the 4 books are about Emile's education. And I guess one way to put the question is why isn't, I mean, you pose them in terms of a kind of a couple alternatives, like you know, an ancient alternative or living alone. But what about, like, to return to earlier in our conversation, the Montessori alternative, right? That is the reading of Rousseau's Emile that says, look, this is not a parent that's educating Emile. This is a tutor, right? So that's, you know, significant that it sort of takes it out of the parental setting, and that's significant and important. And it involves that government by necessity. So in other words, getting the child to sort of work out the problems on his or her own. Obviously, this is not going to be perfect, the Montessori solution, because kids are going to inflame one another's amour propre and so forth. But again, you know, the Sophie's solution is not a perfect solution either. So I guess, you know, in thinking about those two alternatives, why not think the Montessori one, I guess, is the more authentically Rousseauian one?
Well, I think you have to think about whether Emile is a success, right? Emile as a character ends up being what Rousseau sets him out to be, right? Which is a kind of natural man who is good for society, right? It's just a man good for others. And it's actually not clear that he is, right? So, I mean, we have a person who has no real attachments to anybody. I mean, that's the outcome of his education. There's a line, it's sort of at the beginning of book three, where he says, like, Emile is, you know, he regards his sister as his watch, basically. I mean, he values them about equally, right? I mean, and that's the goal, because he's not allowed to have any moral precepts. And obviously, love of your family would be a moral precept. He's not allowed to be exposed to that yet, because he doesn't have the capacity for moral reasoning. But the result seems to be that he's an extremely cold person with no attachments to anybody. I mean, you know, Jean-Jacques substitutes at the time when he's, you know, he hits adolescence and he has this sexual desire. So he fixates it on this ideal object, Sophie, who Emile hasn't met yet. And in the meantime, subjects him to all of these unfortunate people, right? So this is his lesson in friendship is a lesson in pity of the unfortunate, of those who are less well off than him, because it would be a problem for him to be exposed to equals, because equals generate jealousy for Rousseau, right? And pity is a kind of salutary emotion, because you're not jealous of people who are worse off than you, and you think only of how you can try to help them. And that's very nice. Except that, you know, as a human being in society, you would not be able to really function, right? So you can think of it from the perspective, this is the way that I put it in the book, of, you know, the book is addressed to mothers. And in book one, Rousseau does this little underhanded thing of proposing to the mother that she nurse her own child and raise it, and to the father that he educate it. And then he says, but I know you're not going to do that. So I'm going to take the child away from you, and I'm going to assign it to this tutor, Jean-Jacques. And Jean-Jacques will have essentially full custody of this child, and you will no longer be necessary. And that's how we're going to raise this child. And so the whole sort of trick of bringing the tutor in the first place is sort of premised on taking it away from the parents, right? It's premised on the parents not caring enough to do this themselves. And there's a sense in which the outcome of Emile is revenge against the mother who doesn't want to raise him, because Emile doesn't love his mother at the end. Emile doesn't care about his parents. They don't even exist in his mind. The only person he cares about is Sophie. And Sophie is a kind of solution to a physical problem for him, right? She's, you know, you develop these moral attachments, but ultimately, like, he's not attached to anybody else. So there's his tutor, who he's dependent on. He feels he can't live his life without him. And there's Sophie, who he's dependent on because she's a kind of vehicle for his sexual desires. And there's nobody else. And so from the perspective of the parents of Emile, he's a big failure, because he's not their son. He doesn't love them. They have no family with him, right? And so I think we're not supposed to see Emile as, like, a great social outcome. He is good for himself, but he's not good for others. And it's not even clear that he can be a good father to his children, which is a problem that comes up at the very end of book five, where, you know, when Sophie tells him that she's pregnant, he runs to the tutor and says, like, I beg you, help me now. I don't know what to do, right? But this is supposed to be the moment at which the tutor is done. And he's now sort of being roped back in to assisting with the children. And you can see why that is, because raising children requires this understanding of society, this understanding of opinion and how it works, this understanding of amour propre. Sophie has it because she was raised in it, But Emil has no idea. And so he has no ability to understand. He's not capable of understanding that he has to protect his children from moral ideas, right? That he has to make everything seem like necessity to them, because all of that was done to him. And he was never informed that it was all a kind of facade, right? That would bring the whole thing crashing down. So he believes that what was done to him was just what had to be done, and that it wasn't orchestrated. But for his own children, he's going to have to orchestrate it. And he doesn't know how. And it's only Sophie who has this kind of knowledge. So I think that the problem with extrapolating from Emil is that it's based on the assumption that Emil's education is successful for the purposes which Rousseau sets out. And I don't think we have a lot of evidence that it is, actually. And there's actually a lot of red flags if you read it as a book to mothers, that this is a warning to mothers. It is not supposed to be a kind of a celebration of an ideal education. It's supposed to be, this is what natural education would require. And the person that it would produce would be incapable of living in society. I mean, ultimately in the sequel, Emil leaves society and becomes a solitary. He'd be incapable of living in society. And if he had to live in society, he wouldn't really be good for anybody else.
Great. So I have two last questions for you in terms of the sort of contemporary significance of your book. The first one is, we came past the 2-year anniversary of COVID here, in which many parents sort of were thrust into homeschooling their kids, maybe in many cases unwillingly. Would Locke and Rousseau, if they were around today, be in favor of homeschooling, or would they, you know, is there some model of education and parenting that they would sort of glom onto most?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really fascinating question, because I think the really big and obvious shift that has occurred since Locke and Rousseau is democracy, right? I mean, they're writing for kind of liberal aristocracies, where you have a whole class of people who are essentially a leisured class that can sit on a country estate and educate their children full time. And that's very much the goal for both of them, right? That's the education that they see as ideal under the circumstances. But in America, that isn't really possible. We don't have a sort of landed gentry. We have rich people, but even rich people have to work. And in fact, rich people often work more than other people, or at least more hours. And so we have this problem of universal liability to labor, as Marx would put it, that would really get in the way of doing what Locke and Rousseau proposed faithfully. So in a way, we have two options, which is we can try to form schools that do that, right? Or we could say, well, we want homeschooling, and I don't know, we're going to organize society in some way that everybody could try to homeschool, which is what people in effect did in COVID, although we didn't help them out much with that. And so I think, you know, universal homeschooling in a democracy is not possible. It's not something we should hope for. It would not work out very well. I don't know. I mean, I think the numbers of people who will homeschool more permanently definitely will go up as a result of people's experiences in COVID. It's not a bad approach. And I think that a lot of people will discover, or have discovered, that it's actually much more doable than they thought it was, which is true for a lot of reasons and for a lot of people who don't do it. But on the whole, school is a democratic institution. School is the democratic answer to this problem of universal liability to work, of the fact that, you know, in a democracy, very few people are rich enough and leisured enough, really leisured enough, to give their children the kind of education Locke and Rousseau are describing. And so the American answer is really interesting. And this is the subject of my next book that I'm working on now, which is how they try to adapt Locke's and Rousseau's fears of about public schooling, or schooling in general, institutional schooling. That the sense that if you leave children with their peers, if you sort of set them with their peers, they'll be totally tyrannized by them. And that's like a kind of unmitigated public opinion imposed on them very early on by other people who don't even understand what they're doing. And that's sort of, you know, what we today would call peer pressure. But, you know, it's a kind of pure tyranny of the majority in a Tocquevillian sense. So that compromises intellectual independence. And so to the degree that Americans are also liberals and are worried about intellectual independence, right? How is it that the American educational tradition deals with this fear while still advocating for institutional schooling, which Americans have done since the 1780s and 1790s. And I think it's a really interesting question. And the answer to it is that we have schools and we hate schools and we resent our schools in some in the way that I did when I was suspended from school and, you know, was often insubordinate. We have this kind of culture of resisting school and of not taking school seriously, of not taking teachers seriously, and in general of being very skeptical of institutions of schooling, and at the same time very dependent on them. And I think that that's actually a pretty conscious development. And we can, if you look at writing, American writing on education, you have kind of two strains of it. One is sort of the official, the professional pedagogues, the policymakers, the sort of philosophers of education who are always promoting expanded schooling, schooling as a sort of solution to all kinds of social problems that go beyond educational problems, right? Schooling as a solution to poverty, schooling as a solution to, you know, drug use, schooling as a solution to all kinds of other problems. And then you have this kind of contrary tradition, mostly in our literature, in American literature, that just mocks school and treats it as, you know, a thing to be overcome essentially as part of one's education, that education is this thing that sort of transcends school and often is undertaken against what is taught in school. And you can see that, I mean, in Benjamin Franklin, you can see that in Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn, you can see that in Little Women, you can see that in Henry Adams's autobiography, The Education of Henry Adams, and you can see it in like every teen movie of the 20th century, right, where, you know, Ferris Bueller's Day Off would be the sort of iconic example of this, right, which is that there's school, and in school, that's where Ben Stein is droning on about the New Deal, and everybody is passed out in his class, and then there's education, which is what Ferris Bueller and his friends are undertaking on their, like, escapades through Chicago while the school principal is chasing them around and trying to catch them, and that's sort of our, that, you know, that that has deeply infiltrated our sort of popular vision of education, which is that in a way we want schools, we want them to be good. We're really concerned about schools at the policy level, but at a sort of cultural level, we're deeply skeptical of schools in a way that we don't see in other OECD countries. You know, this respect for teachers is much lower here. Teacher pay is much lower. We have this bizarre decentralized system that no other country would tolerate, where we have, you know, all of these 30,000 school districts that are semi-autonomous, you know, less so than they used to be, but still fairly independent. We have all these private schools, we have charter schools, we have homeschools, we have unschools. And, you know, that's not something that we see more broadly around developed, you know, in developed nations in the West or even around the world. And all of that, I think, is a vestige of this sense that comes from Locke and Rousseau, that there's something dangerous about institutional education, that if what you're interested in is intellectual freedom, individual intellectual freedom, that you can't be too invested in institutions because they are vectors of fashion and opinion in this potentially unsalutary way.
Great. That's interesting, and good luck with the next book. I have to have you on when the next book comes out, continue the discussion. My last question has to do, I guess this is more to do with the content of the education, though it has implications for the form, I think, which is the question about liberal education. So, I mean, one understanding of what liberal education does is precisely that it equips the student with the capacity to overcome fashion and opinion by liberating the soul and giving them a perspective above their particular time and place by allowing them to read books, you know, great books about the past, give them a perspective of different times and places. So to have a sort of critical distance from place. I guess my question is, why don't Locke and Rousseau adopt that kind of approach? Because it seems like it could circumvent, you know, the question about parents or institutional schooling. I mean, if you have liberal education, that's the answer, right? Rather than trying to have parents try to discipline and so forth, what you do is you liberate the soul through an encounter with voices and perspectives that transcend fashion and opinion, rather than trying to, you know, restrict the soul or give it a capacity to sort of, you know, confront fashion and opinion, allow it to transcend it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that just starts too late for them, right? I mean, by the time that you're able to read these sorts of books, you're already in late adolescence. And I mean, that's true even in Locke's curriculum, right? He's having people read, you know, the Romans, Cicero, all of that stuff. Well, Cicero you read early for Latin, but to really understand the politics and the law and all that stuff, that comes much later in the education. And I think for both Locke and Rousseau, the worry is that you're formed by then. And that what you read is going to be interpreted through the kinds of desires that you already have been habituated into. And so it's too late. And I mean, it's not harmful to read that sort of thing, but that education for them is really a process that begins very early. And it's about the formation and discipline of the will before you get any sort of content at all involved. And then, you know, Sophie doesn't really read anything and it doesn't seem to diminish her education. I mean, doesn't diminish her ability to do what she's sort of supposed to do and to be happy. And so for them, it's, you know, and we see this really throughout pedagogical theory that follows them in the 19th century Germans and then in the 20th century, you have to start early because the will is a real problem. And desires are a real problem, and they have to be correctly shaped and correctly formed in order for you to be receptive to sort of the great books or to liberal education as it's conceived for sort of adolescents and older students.
Well, Rita, this has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate you joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.